Hello, I'm Scott Neri, age 278. This is number 0278. What a coincidence! The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0278. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, another visit from NASA expert Rod Pyle, talking about the Orion spacecraft test flight and what it means for manned spaceflight in the future.
The mission was flawless. There was a couple little tiny hitches, but basically every piece of technology worked exactly the way they intended it to. So it was exciting. It was highly reminiscent of a flight called Apollo 4 back in 1967 when they flew the Apollo capsule for the first time unmanned. So, you know, it was less dramatic than that. And it's, of course, you know, 40-something years later, but it's still a great moment. And with the shuttle having been retired for a number of years now, it's just nice to be back.
John Vamvas and Olga Montez, authors of Werewolves, based on their own screenplay. How different was it writing a novel from a screenplay?
It was the first time we had ever written a novel. We'd written plays, shorts, feature films, and
short films.
And just writing a novel, we just saw that screenplays are really just like a skeleton to a story. And so now we had to fatten it up. We had no idea what even...
Which was fun, because we got to describe and tell the story the way we want to tell it. And it was really incredible.
Stuart Nolman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman. And this time, Book Banter offers three titles that must be on your Christmas gift list. So ho, 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 boys and girls. It's happening shortly on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0278 was juggler and actor Scott Neri. Thank you very much, Scott, for doing the latest guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? An Alabama church announced it will start holding services at a Buffalo Wild Wings to reach potential parishioners who wouldn't go to a church. The Reverend Wesley Savage, minister of young adults for River Chase United Methodist Church in Birmingham, said the church is planning to hold Sunday morning services at a local Buffalo Wild Wings in the hopes of attracting worshipers who might be intimidated by the church setting. Savage said, "We hope it's going to be a more inviting atmosphere. The services have been dubbed The Stream, and they are being billed in signs posted by the church as Wings Prayer Sports." However, Savage said the restaurant will be preparing to open during the 45-minute services, so no beer will be served during worship. "I've had that question come up," Savage said. "We're going to encourage people to stay for lunch, stay for sports. This is part of the partnership. We'll help them with their business because they're helping us." Yes. Talk about a wing and a prayer indeed. You know, the good reverend might just find out that folks who might be intimidated by going to church might now be too intimidated to go into Buffalo Wild Wings. And trust me, the hotter the wings, the more it becomes like a resurrection later. You know what I mean, don't you? Yeah. Anyway, India's Orissa state has established health camps to facilitate mass sterilizations to help control the booming population. But procedures were halted in November when Dr. Mahesh Chandra Root matter-of-factly told BBC News that camps routinely used ordinary bicycle pumps to inflate women's abdomens. Orissa's senior health official immediately ended the practice and ordered sterilizations only in hospitals. By the way, for your information, enlarging the abdomen helps the surgeon to operate, but the proper agent is carbon dioxide, not a bicycle pump. Now you know. And you know, if they had put a scene like that in the movie like Dumb and Dumber, everyone would say, nope, too far-fetched. And also, by the way, all of these doctors are still practicing. How safe do you feel in the Orissa state of India now? That's what I want to know. Anyway, moving right along. Okay, for this story, I'm just going to say up front that this is not the idiot of the day, but it's so close. And it's not a Darwin file story, but it's also so close. Let's just call this the Darwin starter kit, because eventually one or both of the pinheads in this tale will leave the planet in some comically bizarre way. Here's the story. A Largo, Florida man was hospitalized overnight after being shot just before midnight in what authorities said was a game between two men pointing loaded guns at each other. Apparently, there is not much to do in Largo after 10 o'clock. According to the Pinellas County Sheriff's Office, 23-year-old Tony Rowe was rushed to the hospital after being shot in the chest. Deputies responded to the home after Rowe and 19-year-old Dylan Harvey engaged in a game in which they were playing with a loaded revolver by rolling the chamber, then taking turns pointing the gun at each other. At one point, when Harvey had the gun, it fired, striking Rowe. The sheriff's office is calling the shooting accidental for now. An investigation is ongoing. Rowe is expected to survive his injuries. So, doctors have saved Rowe from a bullet wound. The major question, however, is who will save Rowe from himself? That's what I want to know. And while you're still digesting that last story, we actually have a few new entries into the Darwin file, because as you know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. These items all come to us in a little-known sidebar called Armed and Clumsy, and we actually have three of them. Number one, 28-year-old Ralik Hansen, suspected in a dramatic New York City jewelry robbery, heard a knock at the door of a Brooklyn home in October, squeezed under the couch, and accidentally shot himself to death. He thought he was hiding from the police. It was a delivery man. Oops. Number two, 57-year-old Dennis Emery, who, according to neighbors, was a frequent gun brandisher at home in Pinellas Park, Florida, accidentally mishandled one during a November domestic argument and fatally shot himself in the face. And by the way, that's two stories from the Pinellas, Florida area, by the way, we've had in the last little while that deal with people not too bright with guns. And number three, a 26-year-old woman in St. Louis who had recently purchased a handgun to protect against potential violence in Ferguson was waving it around while riding in a car with a friend, causing him to grab for it, and a shot fatally struck her. Wow. However, by the way, police have not closed that case. They're still pending the idea of whether it was just a dumb accident or, you know, anyway. To paraphrase the opening notes of Dragnet for all of these three stories, dumb, da-dum, dumb. That's what's going on there. Shall we get to our first guest on the Stuff Hall program with me, Peter Anthony Holder? Oh, yes, let's do that, shall we? After four decades of waiting, the dawn of a new era in space exploration finally began with the Dawn liftoff of NASA's first Orion spacecraft recently. So just how has this test flight relit the path to send humans beyond low Earth orbit? Well, NASA historian Rod Pyle is back on the show to talk about just that. He joins us once again from California via Skype-to-Skype communication. Hi, Rod.
Good evening. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program once again.
Right.
So people who are excited in space travel have something to be excited about once again. How do you feel about Orion taking off?
You know, it was a great experience. I was at JPL. They were kind enough to be open and let the press in. So we had our disappointment the first day because apparently a cruise ship wandered into the fallout range. And then after that, they had, as you know, valve problems and so forth. Second day, went off like clockwork right away, and it was really exciting. The mission was flawless. There was a couple little tiny hitches, but basically every piece of technology worked exactly the way they intended it to. So it was exciting. It was highly reminiscent of a flight called Apollo 4 back in 1967 when they flew the Apollo capsule for the first time unmanned. That flight went out about 17,000 miles and came back into the atmosphere at a white-hot 24,000 miles per hour to simulate lunar reentry speeds. This one went out 3,800 miles and came back at about 20,000 because the rocket wasn't as large as the one from the 60s and the capsule's larger. So, you know, it was less dramatic than that, and it's, of course, you know, 40-something years later, but it's still a great moment, and with the shuttle having been retired for a number of years now, it's just nice to be back.
And from a dramatic point of view, what did NASA learn, because you mentioned Apollo 4, what did they learn in Apollo 4 in going forward with the rest of the mission that eventually went to the moon, and conversely, what was learned in this mission?
Apollo 4 was the first time that anything had really gone that far out of Earth orbit. One of the Gemini flights, one or two of them, went up fairly high, a couple thousand miles, just to try it, you know, to see if they could change orbits like that and maintain a stable orbit, because it had never been done. And Apollo 4 was another never been done in a couple of ways. Nobody had flown that far out. Nobody had reentered that fast. They really needed to test that heat shield and make sure the thing wasn't going to melt on the way in. And guidance and trajectory control and life support and all that stuff. So that was critical to being able to take the next steps. And interestingly, they only did one more test on the Saturn V. They added the LEM to that one before they flew Apollo 7 in orbit, and then they sent Apollo 8 out into lunar orbit. And when you look at that from today's perspective of a safer, saner NASA without a schedule, at least not one like they had then, you kind of scratch your head and say, I can't really believe they did that because, you know, especially Apollo 8, the LEM wasn't ready. So it was just the command module and the service module, the booster unit behind it with life support and all that. Had anything gone wrong, like it did on 13, they'd still be out there somewhere, you know. So it was really, really pushing the envelope and quite risky. Now, in this case, the primary function here was you got to test the hardware. Even 50 years later, almost with all the things we know now and all the improvements, the better electronics, the glass displays inside the cockpit, all this stuff, you still need to just test it and make sure it works. And it did. Here's the main problem. With the budget level they have now, which is a tenth of what they were using in the 60s, and in the 1960s, it was basically Apollo and a couple of Mariner spacecraft and some stuff they were ramping up for. Now they've got dozens of different programs they're running. They got Mars rovers, they got orbiters, they got stuff out by Jupiter and Saturn, all kinds of Earth orbiting spacecraft, and the space station to maintain and pay for. So when you take the tenth of the budget and distribute it like that, you don't have much left. So what that means is we have this flight, we got another unmanned test flight that's going to loop the moon in 2018 at this point, if they make it. It's December 2018 is the schedule. And then nobody steps foot in that thing until 2021 at the earliest. So there's a lot of downtime. And as prominent a person as Chris Kraft, who, as you probably remember, was Mr. Mission Control from the time it started till the 80s, well into the shuttle era, has said, you know, with that kind of downtime, not only can you not amortize the cost of this thing, and it's going to be a couple billion dollars a launch, which is too much, but you can't keep the people trained in Trosty. You can try. But during the height of Apollo, they were launching about every 2 months to 10 weeks. With these many years down in between, there's a lot of concern that some of that tension is going to get lost, and that's not necessarily a good thing.
Right. And when you mentioned a tenth of the budget, you're talking a tenth of the budget in actual dollars, not taking into account inflation.
Well, this is adjusted dollars. So
okay.
It was at that point, it was 5% of the national budget. And now it's a fifth, a 0.05. So it's literally a tenth of what it was.
Wow. Okay. Now, I know we discussed this in the program in the past, but is part of the problem this time around, as opposed to back in the Apollo days, the fact that there was an urgency because there was a mortal enemy we were trying to race to the moon? In other words, would we have gone to the moon as fast as we did if it weren't for the Russians just behind us in the space race?
No chance. We had a perfect storm. We had the Russians. We had the emergence of this technology that was just barely possible to do it. And we had a president who made this proclamation, which even surprised the guys at NASA. There was a lot of people at the top of NASA looking at each other going, oh, yay, how the hell are we going to do this? We don't even know what questions to ask. And then, of course, Kennedy was assassinated, so this became a political hot potato. And it's not something that's talked about a whole lot, but regardless of what side of the aisle you were on, because there were people on both sides wanting to cut Apollo dollars as early as 1965, but if you tried, you know, James Webb, who was the administrator that had a heavy, a pair of very serious butt-kicking boots on, he was a tough guy, would look these people in the face and say, you really want to take away our departed president's program, and they'd shut up. So you had all these factors coming together at once, and then this proclaimed by the end of 1969 deadline, and they barely made it. You know, they only had a few months left, and had they had any more issues than they did, it would have stretched well into 1970 or beyond, but it didn't, and as you know, it was a fabulous success. We don't have that now. We have concerns about, oh, the Chinese are saying they're going to the moon by 2020 or so. And every now and then the Russians say something about, oh, we're going to build a new space station, or, oh, we're going to build a moon base, or, oh, we're going to, you know, send people to Pluto or something. I mean, they come out with all kinds of bizarre proclamations. That's one part of the defense minister, the defense establishment, and not the space agency. They don't make those kind of proclamations. So really, the only tangible competitor, if you will, at this point is China. And then the question becomes, well, do we need to compete in that way? I think there's a lot of concern about falling behind in technology and education and engineering. And I think it was this week that our economies finally traded places, as has been predicted for a long time. But is competing with them by returning to the moon, where a lot of people feel we've already done what we needed to do? I don't agree, but many people do feel that. You know, is that something we really need to compete with? And I think a lot of people don't think so at this point. Once they're closer, it'll be interesting to see how Congress feels about that.
If NASA is competing with anyone, is, as you say, another country like China, or is it with commercial endeavors?
You know, the commercial program is actually working out better than I thought it would. They're not getting enough money yet, and that's slowing it down a little bit. But I got to say, NASA's been pretty darn cooperative. There's a lot of concern early on that they were going to pull this kind of stuffy old guard start shirt thing and say, well, space is ours and we'll let you know and we want you, kid. But they've been pretty cooperative, even as far as going to the space station, because there's a lot of concern about, you know, can private industry do that without banging into the thing? And they still do arm grapples with SpaceX, for instance. But it's been very successful. They have awarded contracts now. So they got SpaceX and Orbital Sciences, Boeing, under contract to finish their man-rated capsules. And SpaceX will be flying, they claim, at least by 2017, maybe even earlier. So it's been successful so far. Now, that's, of course, just Earth orbit. Elon Musk has said stuff about, I'm sending people to Mars, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And he certainly isn't somebody I'd bet against on the best of days, because he does what he says he's going to do. But at this point, all we know for sure is they're slated to go to orbit in a couple of years and take the load off of NASA, or at this point, paying the Russians to ferry us back and forth and make that an endeavor here. So it seems like the general framework of the partnership is SpaceX and Boeing and maybe a couple of others that come along later will do the work of taking people and supplies to orbit and ferrying back and forth and short duration spaceflight. And then this leaves NASA to be able to stop messing around in orbit and go out and do the beyond. The question at this point, of course, is what's beyond? The Obama administration famously canceled the Constellation Return to the Moon and is now advocating this asteroid redirect project, which is going out and grabbing an asteroid, dragging it back to lunar orbit, and then we go visit it and hang around for a couple of days and break some pieces off and come home. I'm simplifying a lot, obviously. But there's a big chunk of the Hill that says, that doesn't make sense to us either scientifically or in terms of an ennobling goal. Let's go back to the moon and head for Mars. And you heard a lot about Mars in the NASA announcements after this Orion test. And it was, you know, it was good PR. It was a bit of hyperbole that it's basically kind of like having two wheels and saying, what do you think of my car? You know, there's a lot of steps left to do before we're ready to take a Mars trip. So this was just the slightest little beginning. But I think to get back to the point, the cooperation between private and public is actually working out better than a lot of people thought it would.
Okay, well, you just have about a minute, so I have one last question, and that is, with the launch of a test reflight, a flight rather, of Orion, what do you think will take to get the imagination of the public behind this, or is that possible? I don't think it can happen to Apollo levels, but maybe somewhere in between.
You know, if we come up with that answer, we can open a consultancy and name our price, because that's the big question that NASA's been asking. JPL has their approach, which works pretty well. NASA headquarters has had a tougher time selling the program. It has generated a lot of enthusiasm, but as you know, these things are fickle. And with all the different messages out there and all the different media you can utilize, I anticipate it'll go cold within a couple of months and they're going to have to start over. And it's a tough haul.
Wow. Sad to hear that, but excited to hear that at least they're giving it the the old school try, as the saying goes, and trying to get back into space once again with Orion. I'm looking forward to hearing more about that. Rod, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks once again for chatting with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
NASA expert Rod Pyle. He's also the author, by the way, of Curiosity, an inside look at the Mars rover mission and the people who made it happen. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0278, and you'll find links to Rod's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holden.
And still to come on the program, we'll meet the authors of Werewolves. Plus, Stuart Nolman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. And, of course, there is indeed an Idiot of the Day coming your way. And lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a Tokyo restaurant, announced couples will not be welcome at the eatery on Christmas Eve because the sight of them would make single customers feel lonely. The Paya Paya restaurant posted a note in its window featuring a hand-drawn couple and a heart that have been crossed out with an explanation stating, "We will be refusing entry to all couples on December 24th with no exceptions." The note says couples would serve as a reminder of loneliness for single patrons on Christmas Eve, and romantic pairs would cause severe emotional trauma for members of our staff who have to work on the holiday. Paya Paya worker Takashi Koyozuka said the sign was posted because eatery staff don't want customers to feel sad that they are by themselves. To start with, someone said we should ban couples as a bit of a joke, but then we realized that it's true. If you are single on Christmas Eve, then it's easy to get down. Oh. My. God! What a pile of steaming excrement. That is the dumbest idea I've heard from any coddling nanny state ever. Here's what I'd like to see. Because the restaurant doesn't want anybody to feel lonely, they refuse to serve couples, with the end result that nobody shows up, and the only people feeling lonely would be all the employees at the restaurant twiddling their thumbs. That would be justice. Wow. People are getting really too touchy-feely in this world, aren't they? Absolutely. Okay, this is yet another story of government inaction using some rather questionable judgment. Assistant Attorney General Karen Strawn of Maryland issued an official warning recently for consumers to watch out for what might be called the $100 bill on the windshield scam. That is, if you notice a $100 bill tucked under your wiper, do not try to retrieve it. It is likely there to trick you into opening your door to a carjacker. Now, when questioned by WJLA-TV of Washington, D.C., Strawn admitted that there were no actual reports of such attempts and that the story is a well-known urban legend. But, nonetheless, defended the warning to an urban legend, to something that has never happened. Yeah. Talk about Chicken Little. I mean, oh, please. Somebody stick a $100 bill to the outside handle of her office building, and then when she goes out for it, boot her ass to the curb. Seriously. Meanwhile, elsewhere, the Tempe, Arizona Police Department has indefinitely postponed a fundraising run that it sponsors due to the civil unrest spawned by police officers in other parts of the country shooting and killing unarmed black men. Said Police Chief Tom Riff, "I have determined that out of sensitivity, respect, and support for all sides of an important debate taking place all across our great country, it is necessary to proactively postpone this year's race." Apparently, it's not the fundraiser itself that's the problem, but rather the name given to the event, the annual event, when it was started 3 years ago. And Riff says he doesn't want to let the name misconstrue intentions about the event. Oh, what's the name of the event, you asked? Oh, I'm glad you did. It's called the Run from the Cops 5K. Yeah, that name doesn't really work anymore, does it? Although I'm curious to find out how much of a head start you would get in an event like that. And elsewhere, 40-year-old Gregory Douglas allegedly used a yard sale in Rayburn, Pennsylvania to pass a number of counterfeit $20 bills. Amy Miller, who ran the yard sale, detected the counterfeits after Douglas left and notified authorities. Amy knew how to detect counterfeits from her job training. She works at a bank. After Douglas paid and left, they discovered the money had the exact same serial numbers. Douglas, who was also wanted on other charges, was caught and arrested 2 days later, and counterfeiting and theft by deception charges were added to the list. He was jailed in lieu of a $220,000 bail bond. And I'm guessing, in his case, they're not allowing cash payments for that bond. Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here's the kind of whacked-out story that I personally just live for. A hunter in Stormville, New York, bagged a deer. He was apparently alone and used a handcart to transport the dead animal out of the forest to his truck. You could already see where this is going, don't you? Yeah. Another hunter saw the deer moving through the forest, figured it was alive, and took a shot. He hit the first hunter in the hand and the butt. The unnamed injured hunter was taken to the hospital and is expected to survive. When I first saw this story, that was my LOL moment. And new rule, a day-glow vest for every hunter and an extra one to dress up each deer they get. That's what's going to be needed. Anyway, on to our next guests here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. John Vanves and Olga Montes are the authors of the horror novel Werewolves. The novel is based on the screenplay that they also wrote. John and Olga join us right now via Skype to Skype Communications to talk about Werewolves. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hello, hi.
Thanks for being on the program with us. Right off the bat, I want to bring up the point. Werewolves is spelled differently. There's an H in there. It's W-H-E-R-E, Wolves. What's the meaning between of the title?
Well, you'd have to read it to understand it, and once you read it, then you'll see that the title really makes sense. It's deliberate, obviously, and
we'd be giving it away if we told you.
Fair enough. Understand. So this is, as I said in the introduction, a book that is based on the screenplay that you've written. So is that a different writing muscle for the two of you to go from screenplay to book with the same subject matter?
Absolutely.
Big time.
It was the first time we had ever written a novel. We'd written plays, shorts, feature films.
Short films.
And just writing a novel, we just saw that screenplays are really just like a skeleton to a story. And so now we had to fatten it up. We had to, like, we had no idea what even...
Which was fun, because we got to describe and tell the story the way we want to tell it. And it was really incredible.
And not just that, we got to think about what these characters look like and their tics and everything. Because as a screenwriter, you just leave it as blank, as neutral as possible, so that the actor can have something to play with and come
and
up
the director.
With, and the director and come up with their own idea and their own interpretation and their own tics and their own way of talking, walking, and everything that will give the make the character their own. And so as writing the novel now, we had to give all that, and that was a lot of fun because we got to almost like act them all out and feel them out, and that was really something.
Since it is written from a screenplay, I've got to ask about the film. When will that be coming out?
Well, it's with our agent, and we have an agent, Whit Brantley, in Aiken, South Carolina, and he's trying to move it, so it's not coming out yet. We're just trying to get it out.
Once we wrote it in 2010, it was in pre-production for about a year and a half, and then things just fell apart. And so that's when we decided to write the novel.
The novel while we waited for somebody to pick up the film script. So now we have the novel. Our literary agent, he's trying to also get the graphic novel out of this. And in the meanwhile, he asked us to write a sequel. So we're working on Werewolves 2, T-O-O. And we'll see, we're like a third way or halfway through that.
Excellent. So we should mention that you two guys, you've been together for years and you've written together for years. So
almost 23 years.
Congratulations. So on being collaborators, as I said, it's a different muscle going from screenwriting to doing the book. What about just meshing two writing styles together? Do you have the same, or at least when you started, did you have the same writing styles? And was there a difficult period to mesh together as you started writing, or was it instantaneous?
No, it always clicked. We met on stage, acting on stage, and it always just clicked. It was just like it was yin and yang, and we just really balanced each other out. And once we started writing, we had only started writing because we would tour plays like all over Canada and the United States, and we had been looking for a two-hander to tour, and we couldn't find one that suited our energy.
So we called the writer that we had just met, and we asked him if he had another one. And he said, no. He goes, well, why don't you write your own? I said, I can't write. He goes, yeah, just try it. And we started writing, and here we are now.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about werewolves. I know you can't tell us why the title is the way it is, but tell us about the story itself. As I said, it's a horror novel, so can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, yes, it's a horror novel, but it's so much more. It's fast, it's slick. There's a lot of social commentary in there.
It's about bullying. It's about bullying, big time about bullying, but we're telling it through, I won't say a fun way, but an entertaining way where everybody is going to watch it. Because if you write something just about bullying, it's only the people that are really interested in these types of stories are going to read it. But if you write a story that's horror, action, entertaining, the whole message will hit you in the back of the head after you read it.
Werewolves are very popular in popular culture these days, and they've been around for a long time. But the one thing that they always seem to have in common, no matter when they're written, and I find it interesting you mentioned bullying in this particular case, is that they're always a metaphor for somebody who is basically an outsider or somebody who's played upon. Would you agree with that?
Yes. And the thing is that these are the kinds of people we find in everyday society all the time. They're all around us. They're in our high schools, in our workplace, and all over our environment. And so it's nothing new or nothing different that we're writing about. We're taking real situations and we're just playing them and stretching them and making them fun and horrifying and astonishing. And we're kind of hitting you with things.
Yeah, but there's a message, but we're not putting it in your face. We're just putting it in the story. There's an opening quote of talking about bullying and
And werewolves.
And Olga will read you the opening quote, just it's small.
One of the characters says this in the novel. What is a monster? Something that grows hair all over and howls? Could be. But the real monster is within. And when it comes out, it's as fugly as you see it, or as it lets you see it.
Wow.
So that's basically what the story's about.
So do either one of you have a monster within?
We all have monsters within. I'm from Côte d'Ivoire, man. I grew up on Barclay Street. Trust me, there's a monster in there.
And Olga, you originally are from Spain. So how did you two meet?
I was producing a play at the Centaur Theater called The Hat Full of Rain, and I was also directing it and starring in it. And we had auditions, and Olga showed up the auditions. I wasn't even there, and they told me, "Oh, you're gonna like this girl," and boy, did I like her. 23 years later, almost.
Now they're always people are always weary about acting, directing romances.
I had a kissing scene with her, and I was scared to kiss her because I thought she was going to think I'm a creepy director.
But we only started dating after the play. Yeah. Like, once the play was over, like, before that, we were just friends and rehearsing and for months. And then after, the play was, like, almost over, then we went out to dinner, and that was that.
And you guys have two kids, right?
Yeah.
We have two kids, Achilles and Daphne.
And how old are they?
Achilles is 7 and Daphne just turned 13.
And are either one of them following in their parents' footsteps?
Right now, Achilles is.
Yeah, Achilles, he's 7. He started going to his first auditions about a month ago, and he's a drummer also. And so he's been drumming for about a year, and he's pretty good for a 7-year-old. And so he drums and he acts now. But Daphne's into editing, actually. She likes to edit.
And One Direction.
Of course. One Direction. So
I catch those guys.
Getting back to werewolves, with the book now out, you're saying you're hoping that this book would help to fast track the film itself.
Yeah.
Has that helped? Has that changed? Do you see a little bit of a light at the end of the tunnel for the film?
A little bit. We've gotten extremely positive reviews. If you go on our website, werewolvesblog.com, there you'll be able to read the first two chapters and see if you like it. You'll be able to read reviews that we've gotten and get a lot more information about a lot of other things.
And about us.
And so at least it has. The story has been getting out there. It helped us get a literary agent and helped us. There was a lot of push from people who had read it who asked us, please, there has to be a part two. There has to be. And we hadn't even considered it, but people really, really asked for it. And so, yeah, that's positive. And also our literary agent wants a graphic novel out of this because there is so much interest. And hopefully this script will get picked up. It's just so hard to get a movie done because it's not just one person or 10 people. It's so many people that are on board, directors, producers, and actors, and art direction.
And big money. Yeah. It's a big production. It's not a small film.
Yep.
We shoot this here in Canada itself, it would be way over $5 million, and that's low budget in the States.
And it's about high school kids, so there are 18 roles, kid roles, and there are 18 of them. We don't just put like 5 main ones and the rest don't speak. There are 18 kids who speak and are all in the same class.
Now, you had a goal, an idea, an ulterior motive in writing this book to help spearhead getting the film made. But besides that, the byproduct is, as you've now discovered, the book is successful and it's taking on a life of its own. Did that part surprise you?
Yeah. I think what surprised us the most was that we really enjoyed novel writing. It's a completely different way of writing. It's a completely different way of thinking about writing, and that was really nice. And it's a lot of fun.
Our editor was really she was a real big help to turn this into a novel, a real novel.
She's a Canadian award-winning author, poet.
Yeah,
Shelley Liddle. She's from Saskatoon and she lives in Edmonton.
She had seen us on stage and she has seen our work, our plays that we've written, and she got interested right away. She read it, and thank God she did. She helped us a lot. Trust me.
Yeah.
So how does one get their hands on the book? I know that you have the blog site, which is werewolvestheblog.com, and it's W-H-E-R-E again, werewolvestheblog.com. How does one get the book?
On Amazon. You can go on Amazon Canada, United States, Japan, Spain, any Amazon all over the world, and you can find it. It's on iTunes or the iStore, I guess. The iStore is on Barnes & Noble, Kobo, anywhere where you could buy an e-book.
Or meet me in any corner. I'll get you a copy for sure. I'll order one for you.
So the e-copy is available anywhere in the world, and the hard copy is available Canada and the United States. I think somebody ordered it from Portugal, sent us a Facebook, and they said, oh, we just got this in the mail. It only took 8 days. They ordered it from Amazon UK.
Excellent.
And they got the novel, the hardback.
Well, congratulations on what you guys have been up to, and thanks for being on the program.
Thank you
for having us.
John Vanvis and Olga Montez, authors of Werewolves. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0278, and you'll find links to their website and also links to Amazon.com, where you can order the book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Reputation, as they say, is everything. So, when the dean of a large law school discovered that his school had a poor reputation according to most polls, he decided to conduct his own poll. He created a list of 10 other schools and asked 100 lawyers to rank them. The list included Harvard, Yale, Penn State, and 7 others. When the results came back, right in the middle of the pack was Penn State. The only problem is, Penn State didn't have a law school at the time. The law school president had intentionally included a fictitious school in his poll to show that even the most educated people sometimes rely too much on reputation when making decisions. Let's be fair, this lesson also applies to how we settle our disputes. Courts have a reputation amongst many people as the only place to resolve conflicts legally. However, other lesser-known solutions like mediation and arbitration can often bring victims better results even quicker and at a lower cost. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And as we get closer and closer to big day, Christmas holidays, and you're wondering what you might want to buy as far as books are concerned, Stuart's here with a holiday edition of Book Banter. Hi, Stu.
Well, ho, ho, ho to you, Peter.
Deck the halls.
Yes, with boughs of holly.
Now, you've got some, books are always a great holiday gift as far as I'm concerned. But you got some ideas for people who are looking to get that perfect book for that right person?
Yes, you know, I review in my Montreal Times column, you know, about 50 books a year.
Right.
Okay, that's a lot of books. And I review, you know, a couple of books, you know, a month with you, Peter, here on the Stuff File program. And so that's a lot of books when you think about it. So every year I always narrow down to my favorite books of the year. And for this edition of Book Banter, I decided on 3 books that I have reviewed that would be great Christmas gift suggestions.
Okay. Book number one.
Well, if you like Hollywood, which a lot of people do, may I recommend Five Came Back? It's by Mark Harris. He's an Entertainment Weekly reporter. And this book focuses on 5 well-known Hollywood directors of the 1940s, John Ford, Frank Capra, William Wyler, George Stevens, and John Ford, who at the time of Pearl Harbor basically gave up their careers in Hollywood, their successful careers, to serve their country in World War II in the Army, basically for, you know, making propaganda films. And this is their story of these 5 great directors and their contribution to their country and a great sacrifice, not only to their careers, but maybe to their lives as well. And the stuff that they put out has been memorable. Like, for example, William Wyler's documentary Memphis Belle gave people a first glance of how dangerous bombing missions were in Europe during World War II. Or Frank Capra's series, Why We Fight, about the reasons why America went to war and how dangerous Nazi Germany and Italy and Japan really were. Or George Stevens, who was one of the first filmmakers to go to the concentration camps when they were liberated and actually showed the horror of the concentration camps, which actually psychologically affected George Stevens after World War II. Great book. Mark Harris is a great entertainment writer. His book, Five Pictures of the Revolution, is also an excellent book. But if you want to see how, you know, everyone made sacrifices, including Hollywood, it's exemplified in this book, Five Came Back.
And you're absolutely correct in saying that Mark Harris is an excellent entertainment writer. So if his regular entertainment work is anything, if this book, rather, is anything like his regular entertainment work, this should be a really good read.
Oh, it is. And it's so well-researched. He really knew his stuff and did a great job talking about these five great directors and the sacrifices they made for their country, you know, during the Second World War.
So this book, again, is called?
Five Came Back by Mark Harris, published by the Penguin Press, and it's $34.95.
And book number two?
Well, Stephen King, he's a prodigious writing machine. And what I like about Stephen King is that he doesn't always have to rely on the horror genre. He likes to dabble in other literary genres as well. And in his book, Mr. Mercedes, which came out earlier this year, he decides to go into the police detective mystery thriller genre. And this is a book about that centers around Bill Hodges. He's a retired police detective for a major American Midwestern city. He's on to the brink of suicide, but one of his last unsolved cases about a crazed lone driver who steals a Mercedes-Benz and proceeds to plow through a crowd of people waiting outside for a job fair to open his doors, which kills 8 people, injures 15, but the killer gets away. And this becomes an obsession with Bill Hodges, up to the point where he's searching for this killer who he calls himself Mr. Mercedes before he conducts his next mass murder spree, which will be at a boy band concert at a major arena. But what I like about this book, it could be a James Patterson novel, but King, with his penchant for, you know, talking about horror stories and writing horror stories, goes into the mind of a serial killer, and it almost reads like Psycho. Actually, he just does it so well, and I give King kudos for you know dabbling in different genres. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but if he decides to do a police detective thriller again, this race against the clock, Mr. Mercedes is a great start.
Now, you know, we have done book banter both on the Stuff File program and on the old radio show for a grand total now of about 25 years.
Yeah.
So when it comes to a year-end program, I kind of guessed that you were going to do Stephen King. And you know why that is?
Why is that?
Well, two reasons. One, because you've done Stephen King and year-ender shows before.
Yeah.
And two, Pierre Burton is dead. And he's not available with a new book. So by process of elimination, it had to be Stephen King. So this book is called?
It's called Mr. Mercedes by Stephen King, obviously. He's the heir apparent to the tree killer, to downing all those trees. It's published by Scribner, and it's $36.
And book number three, last but not least.
Well, Chris Hadfield, true Canadian hero. He was an astronaut, spent 6 months up in the International Space Station from 2012-2013. But Chris was almost like a space tourist. He brought his camera with him. And during the 2,597 orbits that he did around the Earth in the space station at a speed of 17,500 miles an hour, 250 miles above the Earth, he took a whopping 45,000 pictures.
You know, I've seen him doing the press junket these days on that book, and this book really looks like a fascinating book.
Oh, it is. And what he did was, it took 92 minutes to do a complete orbit of the Earth in this in the space station. So what he did was he took the selection of his best photos from the 45,000, that must have been quite the chore, and put them into this book called You Are There. No, You Are Here, I'm sorry. Around the World in 92 Minutes. And it's a collection of photos that are taken. They took from 6 out of 7 continents, and it's almost like the ultimate bird's eye view of the Earth. So anything from like Manhattan during the daytime and the nighttime, the pitted coal and mineral mines of Kazakhstan, the white spotted specks that dot parts of the Amazon River Basin that are actually the snow-capped peaks of the Andes, and the hills in the Defensores del Chaco National Park in Paraguay that resemble the lobes of the human brain. Just how he captures different parts of the Earth, different countries and different regions around the globe. I mean, you could just, sit there and stare at these pictures for hours. And I'm not exaggerating. And just wonder and marvel of how this Earth is so varied and how it's made up. And seen through the bird's eye view of Chris Hadfield's camera, it's just amazing. And the geographical and geological makeup. And also, it's not just pictures. It's accompanied by Hadfield's text, and he's very knowledgeable about, you know, what he's taken pictures of. So it's you know what, you can read this in an issue of National Geographic, but this is a great catalog of basically our Earth and the beauty and splendor that you don't see. You know, the average human being just can't see. And we have to thank Chris Hadfield for giving us this, you know, point of view of the Earth, every 92 minutes from the International Space Station.
And so the book again is, and it's an excellent book. Yes, I agree.
Oh, it is. And it's selling so well, and rightfully so. It's called You Are Here, Around the World in 92 Minutes by Chris Hadfield, published by Random House Canada, and it's $29.95. It's a must for your gift list.
Three excellent ideas for gift giving when it comes to books. You've picked very well this year. Very,
you,
very
Peter.
Well. Thank you very much, Stuart, and best of the holidays to you, and we'll speak to you in the new year.
Yes, and all the best to you and your family, Peter, and to all the listeners out there on the Stuff File program. Have a happy holiday, and you'll hear from me in 2015.
And how can people find you if they want to find you before that?
Well, if you want to catch up on what I've been reviewing over the past year, you could read me in the Montreal Times in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you. Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I got a few Stuff File news stories to share with you right now before we get to our idiot of the day. London's Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph, reported in November that a gardener hired by the House of Commons had spent a day pulling color-changing leaves from the trees on the Westminster Palace grounds because it would be more cost-effective than to rake them all up after they fell. The gardener, whose name sounds like it's right out of a James Bond adventure, Annabelle Honeybun, said that she had 145 trees to service. A local environmentalist lamented denying autumn visitors one of the few pleasures at this time of the year. Yes. Yes, folks. That's government at work for you. And 26-year-old Russian Yenya Bolotov became an internet sensation in November on Facebook, YouTube, and several other news sites by releasing photographs showing a 7-year obsession with modifying his face to resemble that of a platypus. He has stretched 8 parts of his face to affect a duck-billed look, with holes on the side of his nostrils and plugs extending his lips. "I can eat, talk, and speak on the phone like everyone else," he insisted, but is happier now that he can, quote, "live differently." Some internet commentators complain that while Bolotov's face is certainly creepy, they cannot quite conjure up platypus from the look. Now, I have seen the pictures of Yenya, and I must concur that he really doesn't appear to be platypus-like. However, what I do sense is a giant cry for help. Definitely. Anyway, time, boys and girls, for the final story of the day on this program, and that, as you know, would be the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
Okay, this time around we have a twofer, two extremely short stories dealing with extremely stupid people. Number one, a 34-year-old man was arrested at a Tesco supermarket in Bar Hill, England on November 12th when he entered the store and threatened employees by showing them a photograph of a gun. In this case, I don't understand why they didn't just simply give him a picture of money, but I digress. Talk about unclear on the concept. And number two, two men were arrested easily in Silver City, New Mexico in December. Thieves had broken into Javelina Coffee House downtown and dragged away the ATM behind their truck. With the help of a witness, and especially the gouge marks in the street running from the Javelina directly to the nearby residence of the men, police nabbed the two and were still looking for a third. Now, you know I have to ask the questions. Number one, why would someone try to rob a place with a picture of a gun? And number two, why would you drag an ATM leaving tracks from the scene of the crime to your own home? Well, the answer to both questions is quite simple. There's one answer and one answer only, and that's because these people are idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0278. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0278. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. I'm your announcer, your name here. Oh, I'm sorry. This is Ben Patrick Johnson. What am I being paid for this? What? You're flipping kidding me. Okay, that's it. Turn off the microphone.